Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You know, I've been talking about earned media value for quite some time on this podcast. My friends at Eisenberg have just raised the bar on earned media benchmarks with their Social Index. Social Index now gives you globally earned media values across a growing list of 6 geographies for all your KPIs across the top 7 social platforms: Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube. You can now visualize these values for deeper analysis, and they have a look back window over 2 years of historical comparisons. Social Index is updated daily. Don't get stuck with old data. Over 1,000 companies have used the Social Index to understand the ROI of their social campaigns. And if you work with a social agency, you should demand they incorporate earned media values into your reports. Get your earned media value for social content. Visit earnedmediavalues.com/Allen. Again, that's earnedmediavalues.com/ALAN.
For all of us, it's about predicting where the consumer is going and getting half of it right.
One of the things we want to do is create ads that don't suck.
Embracing change creates great possibility.
I'm Alan Hart, and this is Marketing Today.
Today on the show, I've got Mauro Porcini. He's PepsiCo's first ever chief design officer. He joined the Food and Beverage Corporation in 2012 to infuse design thinking into PepsiCo's culture and leading a new approach to innovation with design that impacts the company's product platforms and brands, which includes everything from Pepsi to Lay's, Mountain Dew, Gatorade, SodaStream, Doritos, and many, many other brands. He leads teams across a number of global cities from New York to Dallas to Chicago to London, Dublin, New Delhi, Shanghai, Mexico City, Sao Paulo, and Cape Town. He's also a widely known design thinker and design thought leader, and since 2020, he's been a presenter and judge on the TV show New York by Design and America by Design, airing on CBS and Amazon Prime Video. In 2022, Mauro published his first book in English, The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People, In Love with People. On the show today, we talk about what it means to be a chief design officer, how that role came about at PepsiCo, also how he came from other places like 3M doing a similar type of role. We talk about the scope of design in an organization today. How does design manifest itself in the work that PepsiCo does? Some examples of the type of work that he's doing, and much, much more. You do not want to miss this episode with Mauro Porcini. Well, Mauro, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have this conversation. It's not often I get to go deep on the topic of design, and so I'm excited about that. But before we get into business talk, I have to ask you about the shoe fetish that you have. Tell me, it sounds like it's pretty intense.
Yeah, it's something I love, but it's also a pain. I have almost 400 pair of shoes by now. So I love it because I just love to wear them and choose them and have fun with them because the style is really diverse. So I have a lot of fun with them when I wear them. But it's a pain because I don't know where to put them anymore in an apartment in New York City.
Yeah, it reminds me of, wasn't there like I'm probably aging myself, but a dignitary from the Philippines or something that had a famous.
Yeah, I don't remember the name, but yeah, I think she died a few years ago. And then, yeah.
There are like thousands of shoes or something. So you still got a little work to do.
My wife is helping. She has the same amount of shoes as well. So together we may get there sometimes in the future. What a shallow goal to have in life, right?
It's everybody collection.
Yes.
So I like it. From shoes to design.
If I may add, actually, there is a business component in it. I do it for fun because but when you are a designer, I am a designer, and you work in a business world, and you happen to go in a boardroom to interact with business leaders, with customers, in our case, with the bottlers, so our business partners. There is always that tension between making sure that they understand that you are the creative guy in the room, so that you bring in something that is complementary to their thinking and their mindset and culture. But then, and this is very important, I learned it over time, you also need to reassure them that you are understanding their world, that you're understanding their vernacular, that they're understanding their strategies, so that you can really position yourself as a partner and a co-creator and really add the value that you're supposed to add. So why I'm mentioning this in connection to the shoes, the semiotic of how you look, everything on you counts when you enter a room and people look at you. Even before you talk, we are already communicating, all of us. And so I've been always using the shoes as that detail, that accessory that communicates my belonging to the creative community. And eventually, depending on the kind of meeting, I go more formal, more serious with the rest of the clothes, with a suit, with a jacket.
Right.
And then there is the touch of the shoe. And so there is the balance between I'm dressed like you eventually in my formal suit, but I'm different. And with my diversity, I bring value to this room. So obviously, it's not just the visual cues that you carry with you. Obviously, you need to do that also in the way you talk. This mixing between words like love, that is part of my vocabulary and part of my conversation all the time. And then understanding though how to talk about growth, bottom line, top line, you know, and the business vernacular. Mixing the two words has been always very important for me. And the shoes are a very important component of this, a very subtle one, but important.
I love that. And it does. It does bring who you are to the forefront without even saying a word.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. From those shoes and from what you're trying to do in the business setting, talk to me about your path. Like, where did you get your start? And now you're the chief design officer at PepsiCo.
I'm Italian, as you can hear from my super heavy accent. And I studied design in Polytechnic of Milan, in the University Polytechnic of Milan. I did my thesis in wearable technologies. And so the technology meets fashion, but with a very human-centric kind of focus to create value for people. It was about safety, connectivity, style, comfort. And I mentioned my thesis because that way of thinking that I learned at school has been forming my entire career path. Back then, we were working on how technology will evolve in the next 20, 30 years. Wearable technologies were not existing back then. They are barely existing even today. They are starting. We have some products even in PepsiCo now in market that has been very successful with wearable technologies as an example, but they're not everywhere. So I started in that way. I did my thesis with Philips and Philips Designs, and I started to work in Philips, working on this field. And then I left and I did something completely different. I opened an agency working on innovation, again, technology, but applied to the digital world, with a partner that is totally unexpected, a big Italian celebrity coming from the music world. Imagine I'm 24 and I meet Jay-Z in the US with zero connection because I was coming from a very humble family, from a suburbs with zero connections. And I bump into this big celebrity and the dream come true and we build a company together to work on innovation. Back then we were working from the identity of many singers that he was producing and working mostly on the digital world for them, because it was something totally new for them and for society in general, all the way to what today we call cryptocurrency. And that was really the project that my partner really was investing on, that really believed in, the idea of a digital currency. We're talking about the year 2000. Cryptocurrency were invented then in 2007, 2008. Back then, I learned what innovation is about. He really coached me, he mentored me in what innovation is about without ever in his life, still today, mentioning the word innovation. He was a doer. He was an innovator. He was not one of those amazing storytellers that you find in the business world that talk so well about innovation, but eventually are not really good at doing it. And so I learned a lot with him. I also learned that innovation and timing are connected, and we came to that intuition, obviously, too early. I also learned that innovation and funding are really connected. We didn't have an investment fund behind. The funder, the guy was funding was this celebrity, but obviously didn't have the financial power of a fund. And so, long story short, it's been my first failure. We closed the agency almost 3 years later. I never thought about that as a failure until recently when a journalist was asking me, tell me one of your failures in your life. And until then, for many years, for decades, I've been answering, mentioning projects and things that didn't go well in the companies I was working for. And then one day, I don't even know why, I realized that actually my first big, gigantic failure was when I had to close my agency. But why I didn't realize it before is because I never saw that as a failure. I learned so much in those years. And again, who I am today is because I had the failure. But again, never saw it as a failure. I saw it as an experiment eventually. Close that.
I
joined 3M, the tech company from Minnesota, as design manager in Europe for one of the 6 businesses they had, the consumer business. And then in 10 years, I moved to the United States. I become the first chief design officer of the tech company, of the global corporation. And then almost 12 years ago, the call from PepsiCo arrived from Indra Nooyi and Brad Jakeman, the CEO and the president of Global Beverage, to join this amazing company. And I left 3M and I started the journey again from scratch with no team. And at 3M, by then, I was the chief design officer with teams in Japan, in China, in the US, in Italy, in Brazil. And I had to start from scratch. And I got out of my comfort zone. I did it. And I'm really happy of that decision, even though I still love 3M as well.
Yeah. Even with your quote-unquote failure of an agency, you've had an amazing career at 2 very storied companies, right? 3M and PepsiCo. I'm curious, though, what was PepsiCo looking to do? Like, why would they create this chief design officer?
First of all, there is the eternal, I would say at this point, competition with our friends in Atlanta with Coke. and design was a buzzword. Back then, Coke structured, created a design organization under David Butler. And I remember as chief design officer of 3M, I was named by Fast Company one of the master of design of, I don't remember what year. And David was the master of design of the year before. So few chief design officers were starting to emerge. So on one side, I think the company started to realize that design was becoming an interesting competitive advantage for any kind of organization. Indra, the CEO back then, also told a few years before with Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs told her that if she was really serious about creating value in this evolving society for the company, she needed to invest in design. She tried doing that by working with external agencies. And at a certain point, she realized, together also with this other guy that I mentioned, Brad Jakeman, the president of Global Beverage, they joined the company 1 year before me. Together, they realized that design was not about a project done by an external agency. Design was, before anything else, a different kind of culture of doing things, of doing marketing, of doing branding, or doing innovation, or the way you do R&D. Even the way you do finance, HR, design thinking could impact anything the company was doing and shaping a different approach to branding, innovation, and growth at the end of the day. So those are just 2 of the anecdotes that I could mention. But in general, it was really the intuition of a couple of people at the top that understood that you needed to change the way of doing things to be competitive in a world that was evolving. And so they found this guy in an industry was completely different. I mentioned this because many people listening to us may think, well, maybe I want to invest in design, or maybe I want to invest in a different kind of capability. Something I think that unique that happened in the moment is that Indra and Brad didn't choose somebody coming from CPG, a packaging designer, a brand designer.
Right.
I was coming from the tech world. I'm an industrial designer. I'm an anomaly as a profile in this kind of world. But probably they understood that what they needed was somebody that could help them building the culture of design, even before doing the right project. I had a good portfolio, so they could see that I was able to do packaging, I was able to do product design, I was able to do those things. But the conversation I had with both of them was about how to design culture. In that interview that day, I remember if it was yesterday, early 2012 with Indra, the conversation was all about how to design culture. And I shared with her five phases I went through in 3M to redesign the culture of design of the company. But at the end, obviously, to help reshaping the culture of innovation of the company as well.
Yeah. Why don't you tell me about the five steps or five phases, if you will?
Yeah. The first one is what I call the denier, is when your company thinks that you need to change, or eventually a leader, somebody in the organization thinks that you need to change, but the vast majority of the organization, the body of the organization, is in total denial. Design. Why do we need design? We've been so successful for so many years without this organization in-house. Why do you need this new capability? If you stay in denial too long, you risk to disappear. Companies like Kodak or Blockbuster. We have many examples in the history of modern history of business of companies that have been in denial for too long. But luckily, often there is a leader, a CEO, that most of the time it needs to be somebody with power that understand that you need a change. And usually what happens is that this leader drives that change top down. It's very difficult for that change to happen bottom up. So here it is, in my case, at the time of 3M, as an example, even before, this is the story I was telling Indra when we interview, the EVP of the consumer business of the company, Dr. Monosari, decided that we needed to drive a change, and he hired this kid in Italy. Now, very safe move in that case. If I was failing in the periphery of the American empire, nobody was going to realize. The move of Indra and Brad, the move of PepsiCo was much more visible because I came in with a press release as chief design officer of the organization. They were also very different times. 10 years later, the world was different. Mm-hmm. But long story short, somebody decides change. And so in the case of 3M, here I am. I take my suitcase. I go to Minnesota and I start to pitch all these ideas, this vision of changing the company with design. And it's great. Everybody loves it. Everybody's excited. And I remember going to the office of my sponsor, of Dr. Nosari, and telling him at the first trip, Dr. Nosari is amazing. Everybody's embracing it. It's going to be so much easier than what we were thinking to infuse design inside the organization. And Dr. Nosari was always a very serious man. That day was more serious than ever behind his mahogany desk in the top floor of the building in 3M. We're still at that time, that kind of setting. And he looks at me. And it's everybody's lying to you. I was like, I was in the room, you were not. I'm thinking, you were not in the room, I was. I have a big empathy, EQ, I feel people. So I tell him, no, really, they were really involved and engaged. And the guy goes on, I'm telling you that everybody is lying to you. And then he explains with a metaphor. He told me, look, Mauro, imagine you are in an art gallery and you have a beautiful painting in front of you and you have a lot of money in your pocket. What do? You buy the painting, right? Mauro, you and design, you are one of the paintings in the 3M art gallery. But there are many other paintings. There is the new plant to invest on. There is the new HR program. Mm. There is the new marketing program. So nobody is buying the design painting. I know, Dr. Nosari knows, because I give them the budget and I know where they're investing the money. That moment changed my life. I was leaving the second phase, that is what I call the hidden rejection. When you think you're getting traction and you're not getting traction at all. This is a very dangerous phase, because you may go on and on for months thinking that things are going well until you realize that they are not, and it may be too late by then. And I see this happening over and over in companies of any kind, of people that try to change things, and there is this slow nod, this passive-aggressive kind of behavior, and things don't change. And by the time people are transparent around the table about what's going on, often it's too late, and projects die, people lose jobs, and initiatives stop. Anyway, it was a big moment also because I realized what to do in these kind of situations. Right. And it's very simple and it's very practical. When somebody tells me, I love your idea, I tell them, okay, let's do it. Invest in it. Give me the money. Give me the people. Give me the money to start the project. Or in some cases, at least, I want your formal commitment. But essentially, you need to involve the person. They need to have skin in the game. Mm. And when you ask them that, the vast majority of the times, 9 times out of 10, and this is statistic coming from another world, but it may be too long to explain, right, but statistically, 90% of the time, people will step out, will be like, yes, I believe in what you're saying, but right now is not the right moment, but let's do it maybe in a few months, the next project, next time, next phase, right, is always next. Great. Yeah. I need to find 1 person out of 10, the 10%, that are going to be with me. I call them the co-conspirators. And with them, you move to the third phase. That is what I call the occasional leap of faith. When these co-conspirators in the organization decide to partner with you to start projects and initiatives. This is a very important moment because this is when you build your proof points. When you essentially, you can be as good as possible in storytelling, in explaining what you want, your vision. But until you land something concrete, the company won't believe you. And so when I joined PepsiCo with HR, we started to map. We created a map with 2 axes. On 1 axis, there were all the projects where I thought the design could really add value quickly. The low-hanging fruit. Right. It didn't need to be perfect. Value. It needed to show progress quickly. Then on the other axis, we put the names of the leaders that were assigned to those projects and the key stakeholders. And I prioritized the projects that were low-hanging fruit, the easy projects to show value quickly. Time was key. I needed to show value quickly with the projects that had the right leaders that could take the leap of faith. And so with them, we redesigned the visual identity of Pepsi. We designed this innovative machine called Inspire, that is a smartphone that lets you customize drinks. So essentially, we land the first few proof points. Once you start to have proof points, more people will come. They will be like, oh, I want to do that in my business, in my brand, in my region. And the answer is always the same. I love it. Let's do it. Give me the money. Give me the resources. This time you have more credibility, more people will come. The more critical mass of proof points you build, the more credibility you build, until a certain point, the organization is, wait a second, here there is real value. This is not just a fad. This is not just the dream of the CEO. This is really something that can create value. Let's scale it up. Let's be serious about this. This is when you move to the fourth phase, what I call the quest for confidence. This is a very difficult phase because in the third phase, in occasional leap of faith, you are in startup mode. You're like a startup. You are pirates, you're pioneers. No process, you just go and literally is a startup. When you move to quest for confidence, you become an enterprise. You need to scale up. Then you need processes. You need a different kind of organization. You need more resources. And with all of this, you increase exponentially the visibility and therefore also the risk, financial risk and also cultural risk and the risk of the initiative and the risk therefore of many people in different kind of positions. This is when this kind of structure, process, and perception of risk kills what made that initiative successful. It was the love, the pirate kind of mindset, the entrepreneurship, the agility, the flexibility. And so in this fourth phase, I call it the quest for confidence, is because in this phase, usually you lose confidence that things can work because you start to face so many roadblocks that the most of the time, companies give up. They are not able to maintain the integrity of the soul of an innovation approach at scale. And so you need individuals, this is where people are really key. Human centricity applied to the people in your organization that know how to navigate the processes and tools that you need. But you need both. You need the heart, and then you need the processes. And therefore, you need confidence. And so if you go through that, you're right to the fifth phase, that is what I call holistic awareness, is when the culture change. But it's not the end. It's the beginning of a new journey, of a new change, because life for people, for companies, is a never-ending journey. You don't want to stop somewhere. You need to keep growing.
No, I love those. I love those phases. And I think anyone listening to our conversation right now probably has experienced something like this. I actually have a few things that are going through the hidden rejection right now. It's very applicable.
But look, this happened to me all the time. But why? Not because your company is bad or your colleagues are bad.
No.
It's just human nature. Mm-hmm. Maslow told us, is the base of the pyramid. Is this need for safety. And human beings see change as a disruption to safety. Even companies, eventually, it's so easy to extract value out of something that is very stable. Even society, we all want stability. We are all built around this idea of stability. Innovation is disruptive, it is inefficient, is risky. So this is human nature, and it's fine. So I never crucify or never point the finger at a specific individual, because I know the root cause of their behavior. They're not bad, they're not mean. But now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't call out their behavior. And this is the problem that we have in companies too many times. We don't call out their behavior. People behave in a way, there is this hidden rejection, and then there is this discomfort in calling out this. And so things go on and on until either it's too late, or even if it's not too late, you're just wasting your shareholders' money.
Time.
It's not, and it's a lack of productivity that is totally invisible. When we talk about lack of productivity and therefore trying to increase productivity, we talk about cutting processes, changing processes, cutting people, cutting investments. We never talk about changing culture. We never talk about kindness, empathy, interaction, and increase exponentially the efficiency and the effectiveness of our teams. We never talk about the slow gnaw and this kind of passive-aggressive culture that builds so much redundancy and inefficiency inside these organizations. So we need leaders that have the courage to call this out with respect, with kindness, once again, but with confidence and with honesty and transparency.
I love it. I love it.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How does design manifest itself at PepsiCo and the types of groups that you're working with?
Look, I'll tell you, it's been a journey also for me that started even before PepsiCo in understanding how to position design inside these corporations. At the beginning, it was all about we need better products. We need that are more beautiful, but also more functional, and more engaging and more meaningful to people. Meaningful is a key word of the design world. We say we don't design products or brands or packaging. We design meaning for people. So that was, at the beginning, what I was pushing inside these companies. At a certain point, I realized that design actually was much more. And it was all about what I call human centricity. Mm-hmm. And what is the difference between the design culture and this idea of human centricity and the traditional marketing or business culture And eventually words like consumer centricity that signify that kind of culture. If you study design at school, they teach you one simple thing. They teach you to observe people like an ethnographer, understand their needs and wants, sometimes even wants that they are not talking about, and then creating a solution for them. The solution could be a product, could be a brand, could be a service, could be an experience, a solution in general, could be all of them together. This is what they teach you at school. And then they teach you, by the way, you also need to make money with it. There is a business component they were going to teach you. And then you need to understand technology, manufacturing, because it's not just about the idea, but you need to understand how to create that idea. So I just mentioned the three lenses of design thinking: people, business, and technology. This is what they teach you. Understanding these three dimensions and prototype solutions in a progressive and incremental way to arrive then to the perfect solution. They also teach you to be a connector, a facilitator, a translator. They teach you all these dimensions, but you're not an expert of marketing, you're not an expert of finance, you're not an expert of human science, and you're not an expert of engineering or biology or chemistry. But you know how to talk the language of all these disciplines to understand enough to connect them all and prototype solutions. Now, this is what you learn at design school. When you go to business school, they teach you something very different. They teach you to grow a business. And they teach you that there are multiple levers to grow that business. One is called product, there is promotion, there is distribution, there is pricing, the traditional levers of marketing mix, and beyond. So you see the product, the solution for people as a lever. But your goal is not to create something extraordinary for these people. Your goal is to grow the business. Mm. That's just a lever. It's a completely different kind of mindset. You may be a superstar marketer that become really successful or a superstar business leader, even if your product is mediocre, if you know how to communicate and storytell the product in a very compelling way, even if it's not a superior product, if you know how to use your pricing or other levers, distribution in a smart way. So now, this has been working very well for the business world for many years. But something is dramatically changing in the past 10, 15 years. The big barriers to entry that all of these big companies used to have are crumbling down under the winds of globalization, new technologies, and digitization. So today, anybody can come up with an idea, get access to funding either online, Kickstarter.com as an example, but mostly through investment funds and incubator of any kind looking for the next big idea. So you get out of school, to think that you can build a startup is not a crazy idea today. It's totally normal. There is a lot of people that do because there is a lot of entities that fund something like this. The cost of technology is going down, driven by globalization. And again, the digitization of the world and other technologies that enable, you know, empower you to manufacture at a lower cost. And then you can go straight to your users, consumers, humans, through the e-commerce channel to sell them stuff and through social media to build your ecosystem of communication. These were all the areas where these companies were building their barriers to entry, made of scale, of production, communication, and distribution. And so today, we big companies know that there are millions of people out there thinking about how to take down our product category, our brands, and today they have the possibility to do it. They could do it online, they can bypass traditional distribution, they can bypass the billions of dollars of investments of these big corporations in media because they have different kind of channels to leverage. And so we are all left, big companies and small, with just one option. We need to finally, thank God, create the most extraordinary solutions for people, the most meaningful products, brands, experiences, and services for people. Mediocrity cannot make you win anymore. And even if you have a mediocre product that is okay right now, your industry is a matter of time. Sooner or later, somebody will come to disrupt and you won't have your barriers to entry to protect you in most of the industries. So this is why now design thinking and design in general is becoming a very important competitive advantage and asset for these corporations, because it's a function and it's a community of people that essentially become the ambassador of this culture, of this kind of mindset, the catalyst of this different approach to business. It doesn't mean that designers will change the world and will change a company. You need the rest of the company to embrace that kind of mindset as well. So you need to marketers to become human-centric, R&D people, finance, all the organizations.
Right.
But designers are trained in that way. If you hire the right designers, they're upset with creating something extraordinary. For many designers, paradoxically, the fact that you even need to sell these solutions and you cannot offer them for free to people is a pain because you are trained in creating something right. meaningful for them and helping people, creating value in the life of people. Then they tell you, you have an obstacle you need to sell them to. Now, this obstacle could be an opportunity because in this society we live in, the more I sell, the more people I reach, the better I do. So that's an opportunity if you look at it in the right. in the right perspective. But again, you have these people inside the organization that will nudge you every day in making the product better, making the packaging better, making that experience better. While 15, 20 years ago, you didn't want to have them. Business people didn't want to have this designer scene reminding them all the time that the products were not extraordinary. Because those products were very profitable and very successful. And it was better to go to an agency, assign them a project, and control them than to have empowered designers pushing for better and better. Today, companies of the world, you want these designers in-house because you want people inside the organization to push for better and better products because that's your most powerful competitive advantage in the kind of world we live in today.
And you have to have them in-house to reshape the fundamentals and framework of culture that drive business.
Yeah, right? Because also, look, innovation, this is something I learned again when I was at 3M. Innovation is not about a great idea. The scientists call that great idea an invention, eventually. But innovation is the ability to take that great idea to market. And this is the difference between, if you go to an agency, they could come up eventually with a great idea. But that is on you, company, to understand how to take that great idea to market in a successful way. And in that journey, you're going to face all kinds of roadblocks. Some of them are more material. It could be the cost of the goods,
right.
the cost of the process to get it to market. It could be consumer research that is telling you not to do it. Because again, consumers usually have a very hard time to understand innovation. They look at the present and the past, and doing innovation just through consumer research and letting consumer deciding for you is like trying to do innovation or driving towards the future, looking at the back rear view mirror and without looking in front. So there are many roadblocks. Some of them are cultural. Is the company uncomfortable with taking a certain kind of risk? Or it could be your sales organization unable to sell certain kind of products that eventually are completely different. Maybe you are a mass market company and all of a sudden, in a market that is totally polarizing, you need to learn to sell also more premium products, as an example. Or in the case of 3M back then, it was a tech company that needed to learn how to sell emotions as well. So it's also cultural. There are many variables. And the only way to do innovation, therefore, the only way to go through that journey in a successful way is by having people in-house, marketing, design, R&D, all the different functions working together to overcome those kind of roadblocks that are also cultural. And therefore, the only approach, the only solution is through an in-house team. But then, just for clarity, we use tons of external agencies and firms. We have amazing partners out there, but they're complementary to us. They help us bring in different perspectives, different kind of talents, type of thinking. Times is bandwidth. You know, they play so many different kind of roles and they're very precious to us. But the wrong model is the one they rely on them to drive the cultural change. That cannot work.
No, it's maybe a bad analogy, but going back to the 3M executive you mentioned about the art gallery, you're asking them to buy that painting multiple times over and over again before they've even decided that's the painting that they want.
Yeah.
Before we switch gears, I wondered if there was any examples from your recent work at PepsiCo you'd like to highlight. And talk about the design aspects or the design process that led you to.
But let me mention, I'll be as quick as possible, three different examples because they're the manifestation of three different goals of designing the company. And eventually, through this answer, I'm going to answer also your previous question about the role of designing the company. So the first one is the redesign of Pepsi. We just launched the new identity of Pepsi. So this is more traditional design. It's what you expect from designing these corporations. It's the logo, it's the identity, it's the packaging. It's been very successful for us. It created a lot of energy inside the organization with our bottlers in the sales organization, in the entire company, a sense of pride as well, and then excitement in the market as well. So this is interesting to see how a simple redesign of a logo, of a brand, can have an impact in the energy of the organization. So this is a traditional design example. Then there is another line of work that we do. There is another dimension of work that we do that is all about experiences, building experiences with our brands. This is very important in this world where we're moving from a marketing-led approach to brand building, a traditional marketing-led approach, approach to the brand building, where essentially you craft a message and you impose it top-down to a receiver, to an audience, to the consumers, traditionally through television, more recently through digital media. Today, that's still very important, but there is another form of content that is the user-generated content. And to have users, people generating that content, you need to engage them. You need to engage with them in a very crowded world where your competitor is not anymore the other drink, the other soda, your direct competitor in your industry or product category. Right. Your competitor, for Pepsi, the competitor become the latest song of Beyoncé, the launch of the Apple latest device. You compete for attention in those few hours per day that people are in front of their screens and they check content and view content. And so in this kind of world, it's very important to be meaningful in the way you interact with your consumers and to reach them wherever they are, including the physical world. So we have been working a lot to create experiences. One of the most recent one and super successful for us was the one at Super Bowl with Cheetos, with Pepsi, with Lays, with a variety of our brands. With Cheetos in particular, we built this chapel where an hologram of Chester Cheetah, controlled by an actor in Los Angeles, but we were in Las Vegas, an hologram was marrying people. And the entire experience was this orange chapel, Vegas style, with Vegas kind of signages. You have props so you could dress up all orange, all in team with a brand. It was so fun. And you had the possibility to then create digital content you could share with the world. And this use of a physical space but with digital technologies was also very engaging. So this is an example. Another one in the world of experience is collaboration, again, with Cheetos that we just launched, Cheetos and Puma. We created this collection of shoes and different gears inspired by Cheetos with the Puma brand. And we launched some of them at the NBA All-Star Game. Or with Shaquille O'Neal, we did this gigantic shoe in his size, that I think is a 22, with a mini Pepsi can inside the sole of the shoe. So these are a few examples of experiences and a variety of different kind of stunt or products and merchandising that are all about creating engagement and user-generated content. And then the last one is innovation. I will mention quickly Gatorade GX, wearable technologies, so something very close to my heart. That's where everything started, is a patch that you put on your skin. It monitor your sweating, composition, and amount of sweating, send information to an app that suggests you the kind of Gatorade you need. You get it in a pod, it's a concentrate. You have a reusable bottle, you fill it with water, you put your pod. The bottle is a smart bottle that gives the information of how much you're drinking, what you're drinking, again, to the app. Four mega trends that you find in almost every industry. Sustainability, health and wellness, personalization, enabled by technology. So these are four vectors that we're using to innovate in many different areas. Gatorade GX is one of these areas. But again, another example of design applied to innovation. So identity and brands, experiences, and innovation. This is what design is about in Pepsi.
Those examples are frankly amazing. And to your point, you call them vectors. I would talk about like the spectrum of different types of design offerings. And that last one really pushing the envelope of reconfiguring a product and almost a system of the business to push the business forward. I really love that.
And
I really
love it. Obviously, it's a very difficult one. Statistically, yes. Depending on the stats you read, but innovation fails, right. Especially in big corporations, between 70 to 85% of the time. So any person listening to us right now, if you are already doing innovation, it is very well. If you are interested in investing in innovation, you need to understand, you need to build, first of all, a financial condition, a financial algorithm that allows you to be inefficient, to experiment and to fail. Right. You also need to build the culture within the organization to protect the people that are driving those kind of projects. Because if they are perceived as failure instead of experiments, these people won't have a long career in your company. And also you won't have engaged innovators and disruptors inside the organization or people that want to do something like this. You also need to manage what's going on with the exterior world. If consumers, customers, media see that you fail often and you don't position in the proper way, they may have a wrong perception of what you're trying to do. Innovation is complicated, but innovation is also very rewarding. And it's not just about the things you do in-house. It's important to have a team, cross-functional, design, marketing, R&D, different kind of functions, envisioning the future. That's why at the beginning of this conversation, I told you those first years, my thesis in wearable technologies, Philips, my experience with the music celebrity and my agency formed everything else. Because back then, I learned the importance of leveraging design thinking to look at the future. What's going on in 20 years? Through the three lenses, how technology is changing and evolving, how business models are changing and evolving, and now society and human beings are changing and evolving. And then going back to today and understanding what are the right experiments to get there as a leader with your company, your brands. Now, these experiments can have different kind of phases. Some of them could be projects that you run. And even there are two categories of projects. There are some that are about quick experimentations, move fast. If you can, if your industry makes sense, leverage e-commerce, for instance, to experiment quickly, learn, fail, get insights, apply them to the next project until you arrive to something very good that you can scale up. The second is, if you want to invest much more, make sure you have a defendable competitive advantage. Most of the time, it's technology driven. It doesn't need to be just that, but obviously technology is a safe one to invest on, especially if the investments are big. That's a more defendable one than many others. And something you can own in time. Also, the advantage of the first comer, if you are the first to market with a new idea, even if it's not technology-driven, again, is a competitive advantage you're going to have in time. The third avenue is joint ventures and partnerships and small investments in startups, in a variety of different organizations to complement something that eventually you don't have. But again, to experiment with agility. And the fourth one, obviously, is traditional acquisitions and M&A. But again, all driven by the vision. Our acquisition of SodaStream, this company, this brand, and this platform mostly, they give you the possibility to create your own drinks with reusable bottles and using eventually the tap water from your house if you live in a country where you have drinkable water from your tap. That was driven also by the kind of thinking inside the organization. The design team has been part from the very beginning of the thinking about eventually acquire years later a company like SodaStream. So these are four examples of how to embrace innovation and strategic thinking and design thinking, not just in application to a traditional innovation project, product design project, packaging design project.
It's been a masterclass in design today. I want to switch gears because we'd love to get to talk about you. We know you at the top of the interview here, we talked about your shoes and the love of that and how it is a character that you take into every meeting and every interaction. But my favorite question to ask everyone on the show is, has there been an experience of your past that defines and makes up who you are today?
Yeah, there was a moment in my life. It was the year 2015, 16, where I went through a very painful experience. I went through a divorce, and it's been really, really painful in many different ways. And I felt for the first time in my life, I've been always an optimist. I come from a very humble family, house projects. We were living in the house projects. We were living, the four of us, we're sleeping in the same room. But even in that tough financial situation, I was always positive, optimistic. My family was like this. And then things went well in life. I've been always happy. I didn't think that going down, depression, could be something I would ever experience in my life. And then something happened late in my life. I was in my mid-40s and I lose control. I go through this divorce and I go in a spiral. I go down and down until I write really, really down, like serious down. And in the moment, what saved me was my family, my friends, and my colleagues that care about me. People that understood the situation without me even talking about the situation and came to me asking if I needed help. I was lucky because I've been always a very open kind of person, so I accepted help. I asked for help. And they saved me, literally. That moment changed so much who I am. I think it amplified something that was already inside me. I come from a family that is all about love and kindness. They're very Catholic. They grew me up with the idea that the most important values were being a good person and culture. And they saw money, success, fame actually as threat to all of this. So I always thank my parents for the kind of culture they gave me. But obviously, in life, then these things stay inside you. During the moment, I realized that actually, they were so right, and they were the most important driver of everything in the world, especially love, care. And then that started a journey to realize that actually that was important, not just in your personal life, but at work as well. And that started a journey that brought me to write a book, The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People in Love with People, that is a business book. It's a book about innovation, it's about branding, it's about also what design did in my life and in the companies I work for to grow these companies. But at the end of the day, it's a book about love and the power of love in the business world. And there is the second part is all about the people. Because if you talk about love, you need to talk about people. It's all about human centricity. Right. And it's all about the 24 different characteristics, the 24 different skills or gifts of these people. And it goes from the ability to think big to the ability to execute things, all the way to the power of kindness, the power of curiosity, the power of optimism, and a variety of other characteristics. But if I want to summarize all of these in a phrase, in a sentence, is the subtitle of the book. And is what literally I learned after that experience a few years ago, is the power of people in love with people. There are three loves that I talk about. The love for the people you serve. So really be driven by creating something meaningful and extraordinary for people, not by making money or becoming famous or getting your next job. Be driven by creating something extraordinary for people, everything else will come. The second form of love is the love for what you do. It's proven that people that love what they do are more successful than people that don't. There are tons of stats about this. The third dimension is the love for the people around you. We live in a world that is not anymore about a one-man show or one-woman show. It's about teamwork. There is this hyper-specialization in every discipline that by yourself is impossible to innovate, even with a small startup. You need multiple people. And so caring for them genuinely, for real, therefore loving them, is fundamental, not just in your personal life, but again, also in the business world. These three dimensions of love are the magic formula for success. Not just business success, even though in a business context is obviously important, but mostly personal success that translates with happiness. And that's the most important thing in the world.
I love it. I love it. And I will link to the book as well so other people can check out go a little deeper in what you just described. I have one last question for you, bringing it back to marketing thinking about the future, what do you believe is the largest opportunity or threat to marketers today?
The largest opportunity, because I see that as an opportunity, is the fact that we live in a world where the traditional barriers to entry are not there anymore. And therefore, you need marketing that is human-centric and focus on creating real value for people. And therefore, the marketing community needs to shift from prioritizing the growth of the business to prioritizing the creation of value for people. In a world where finally, thank God, financial value is aligning with human value. And so this shift of mindset is going to be fundamental for the marketing organization. And when they do that, therefore you need marketers that are very empathetic, that are creators, that are curious, that get out of the office. They don't go to the office from 9 to 5 and they do their strategy and PowerPoints, but they lead into the trends. They understand what's going on out there and they know how to seamlessly translating what they feel and what they see into their strategies and into, at the end, a growth strategy for your organization. But it all starts with creating value for people. Love.
I love it. I love it. Mauro, thank you so much for coming on the show and spending time
with us. Thank you for having me. It's been really a pleasure.
Hi, it's Alan again. Marketing Today was created and produced by me with post-production support from Sam Robertson. If you're new to Marketing Today, please feel free to write us a review on iTunes or your favorite listening platform. Don't forget to subscribe on marketingtodaypodcast.com. Tell your friends and colleagues about the show. I love hearing from listeners. You can contact me at marketingtodaypodcast.com. There you'll also find complete show notes and links to what was discussed in the episode today, and you can search our archives. I'm Alan Hart, and this is Marketing Today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.